What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks. It has been 1,010 days since October 7th, 2023, 1,010 days since Israel launched this iteration of its genocide on the Palestinian people. In that time, tens of thousands of Palestinians have been murdered, most of them women and children, bombed while seeking refuge in structures and tents. Infrastructure is non-existent, including electrical grids, hospitals, and sewage systems. The United States continues to send money and weapons while claiming there was a ceasefire, and the so-called border of peace does nothing to create it. While the world's eyes are diverted to the horrors of Lebanon and Iran, Israel is utilizing the opportunity to rapidly and violently annex the West Bank, working in tandem with the settlers who rob, torture, beat, and steal land and homes from Palestinian people. For the majority of Mondays since October 2023, we have hosted Palestine Post on Law and Disorder in hopes of offering an alternative news source covering the events unfolding in the Middle East, a deviation from mainstream media's talking points that either explicitly or subtly uphold the tenets of Zionism. Here we truth tell in partnership with the voices of the impacted and frontline resistors. We begin today with Ziad Abbas Shamrouk, Executive Director of Middle East Children's Alliance, Mecca for Peace. He is also a filmmaker, journalist, and educator who has worked with Palestinian and international media and has participated in the production of several documentary films. He was the co-producer and production manager of Promises, which was nominated for an Academy Award in 2002. Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
It's good to have you. Haven't seen you in, heard you. We weren't seeing back then. We weren't doing this recording back then. I haven't heard you in a while. Thank you for being here. I actually, for my listeners, Ziad, I want to start with the work of Mecca. What do you all do, and how has that shifted or intensified over the last 1,010 days?
Actually, we are still able to do the work we are doing in the ground. Like, for example, our kitchens, they are already working in Gaza Strip, where we produce over 20,000 hot meals a day, distributed in different parts of Gaza Strip. And the most important is the water project, what we call it Maya project, where we distribute water. We have our own purification and desalinization systems, which we built after October 7th, 2023. And some of these water systems, they are working on the solar panels, where they help and distribute the water for the people in need, especially in the displaced refugee camps. And of course, we do the tracking where we take the water and deliver in different areas. And this is one of the most important project actually right now, what we do in Gaza, especially because it's summer. And summer people, they are living in tents. People, they are not able to access the clean water in Gaza Strip. And this has impacted every aspect of their daily life, the hygiene, the healthy water, the reduce the spread of the disease they are among the people living in the displaced refugee camp. And just to remind the people that there are almost 2 million people they are living in the displaced refugee camps. Most of them, they are living in tents in different parts of Gaza Strip. And we're still working in different other projects where it is important. For example, the psychosocial support for children. We have a school and based in the middle area, 240 children. And right now, for the first time since October 7th until now, we succeed to organize a few summer camps in Gaza Strip for children. Unfortunately, what can you do for children in Gaza Strip? But you try to organize something for them, especially in the middle area and in north of Gaza, where you have one of our summer camps for over 600 children. And we try to organize some activities just to help these children to taste what it means to be a child, to taste the childhood, which they are not able to taste it or to live it at all. Add to that, we have different kind of support for women, especially when you speak about hygiene. This is a major issue right now. We face it in Gaza Strip, where you can access. And imagine that these women, young girls, they need this kind of hygiene, where Israel is still not allowed to get enough stuff like this to get inside Gaza. And of course, the food parcels, distribution, the food parcels, whatever it's come, it's possible for us to get inside Gaza. We try to distribute and reach out to the people inside Gaza. I want to be honest with the people, whatever we are doing, us as Mecca or the other aid organization, they are still working inside Gaza. We are not doing enough at all. We are not covering the needs of the people inside Gaza. One of the main reason is because the way Israel is, they are controlling the stuff to get inside the Gaza. And at the same time, you don't have enough food to get in and to distribute for everyone. Many people, they are still suffering from the starvation. But luckily, we are still day by day, and our kitchen, the water systems, the other activities, and our staff in the ground. We are so lucky as Mecca. We have our staff in different parts of Gaza. They are leading this kind of work with our partners and volunteers. And I want to say, people in Gaza Strip, they are still very active. They take their own initiative. They try to organize themselves. I give the credit for them for all what's going on inside Gaza right now to help and to reduce the impact of this kind of starvation, collective punishment, and of course, ongoing genocide.
Thank you, Ziad. I want to tug on a thread that you lifted up a little bit more a few months back. I think maybe starting at the end of last year, I covered on Palestine Post that Israel was actually attacking aid organizations and kicking a lot of aid organizations out, and in some cases demanding the names of staff. And if they didn't give the names of staff, then they couldn't operate in Israel anymore. In what ways, if any, has the Israeli government attacked Mecca or the work of Mecca? How did you all navigate that time period?
For us as Mecca, we are like many other organizations. We face the main attack, I can say, it's like to make it difficult for the people to do the work in the ground by allowing the aid to get inside Gaza or the medical supplies. This is one of the main attack I consider it like. At the same time, don't forget we have like people, they were targeted and killed inside Gaza. We have many people, they are already working with us volunteers. They were shot and injured. People, they are most of our staff. We have like 20 staff members inside Gaza in different parts. 19 of them, they are already living in tents. They are displaced. They lost their houses. And of course, all the other aid organization. Now Israel make it difficult for all the organization. They ask for different kind of process to where they want to have everyone, the names of everyone they are working with the aid organization. And don't forget Israel targeting everyone, because most of the people they are working inside Gaza, they are Palestinian working with the aid organization. We have over 500 people of them, they are already killed by the Israelis. And many others, they are already arrested and tortured inside Israeli jails, including United Nations. United Nations, they are close to 500, actually 400 people, they are already killed between teachers and the medical sector. They were killed and targeted. And we remember like 2 years ago, more less than 2 years ago, with the 7 people from the World Center Kitchen, they were targeted and killed by the Israelis in that period. Right now, it's like Israel make it difficult because they are asking, they try to control any movement for the aid organization. Some of them, they are already stopped their work. I'm not going to mention the names, but they are not able to produce and to work inside Gaza. And of course, there is a case in the court, even reached the Supreme Court, and this case still more follow up on that, but make it difficult for the aid organization. For us as Mecca, because we are still functioning and working there. Because the way Mecca is working, we depends with our partners. We work mostly with our partners in the ground inside Gaza Strip, and our staff there, they are members. We don't need that kind of control. The control by the Israelis doesn't impact us in direct way, but as doing the work, it's the most difficult by not allowing the stuff to get inside Gaza. Other organizations, they are, like I speak, big organization. Look what happened to United Nations. Even their offices in Jerusalem, they are closed. They don't have any offices in Jerusalem anymore. And still making more difficult for United Nations. United Nations right now, they are suffering a lot from they don't have enough fund to continue to do the work they are doing usually. And if there is an attack, I mean, not only the Palestinians, they are targeted inside Palestine. All the other organization or solidarity groups, they are already become a, what they call it, a legitimate target for the Israelis, because you are not allowed to help the Palestinian and they want to control. We saw what happened with Gaza Foundation, how they tried to come with the alternative where you have over 2,000 Palestinians, they are already killed while they are waiting. because they try to find an alternative for all these aid organization, relief organization working in Gaza. They failed. They failed in that part. But right now they want to make it difficult. And this is part of the plan, actually. This is their plan, to make it difficult for the people in Gaza Strip to survive. They are controlling most of the land inside Gaza. They put the people, over 2 million people, in very tiny area, less than 30% of Gaza Strip. And now they want to control exactly what they can eat, how many calories they have, which kind of medical supplies they need, which kind of vitamins, if it's possible to get the vitamins for children, they are suffering from malnutrition, etc. This is the plan, and it's getting very bad for the aid organization to continue to do the work inside Gaza Strip.
Thank you, Ziad. You are the executive director of the Middle East Children's Alliance, and so I'd like to spend probably the rest of our time talking about children and the impact to it. I don't think we talk about enough. There's a UN report that came out a couple of days ago, not really a report, a statement, for all the utility the UN has been, but anyway, that's a different segment. 241 children have been murdered by Israeli security forces and settlers in the occupied West Bank since October 7th, 23. We know, and I should have prefaced this with all numbers that I say when I'm talking about Palestine are an undercount. So this is just what is officially reported, what the Palestinian Health Ministry can track, etc. We may never know the entire death toll of this. This is in addition to over 21,000 children who've been murdered in Israeli attacks in Gaza in the same period. That's according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health. With murders continuing after the announcement of the so-called ceasefire in October 2025. Since that announcement, 981 Palestinians murdered, and including 183 children, five of whom were infants under the age of one. 48 of the 183 verified children fatalities after the ceasefire announcements were victims of incidents in which only children were murdered, raising concerns about Israeli forces directly targeting Palestinian children. Ziad, do you believe that Israel is intentionally targeting children, and is this something they have always done? Because a reminder, we're focused on the last t 2 years, but this has been going on for decades.
Right. Yeah, for 78 years, I can say. Me, I was born and grew up in a refugee camp. I moved here 2008. I was a child, grew up in a refugee camp. I was suffered like from the Israeli occupation, not only because my family, even me as a child, where you are harassed, arrested, tortured, etc. And this never stopped. Even I am 61 years old right now, and I still have my own nightmares. And imagine for the other children, they are living inside Gaza Strip. Yes, Israel, they have a systematic plan targeting Palestinian children. Even they used to have special jails for children below 18 years old. They are spread in different parts of West Bank and inside Israel. I'm speaking, this is like in late 70s and 80s. Right now, Palestinian children, they are dehumanized like every Palestinian. When I say every Palestinian become a target, everything is Palestinian become a target. The Palestinian house, the Palestinian land, the Palestinian resources, it's become a target. So children, actually, they are a huge issue. And this is the shame for all over the world after all these years. These numbers you mentioned, I don't want to go with the numbers. They are different because we don't have the accurate numbers. But what it's documented, over 21,000 children killed in this kind of period. And you have many thousands, they are already disappeared, where the world, they are not paying attention for that. Israel, they are targeting, when I say Palestinian, by having Palestinian exist in their land, it's become a threat for what they call it, the future of Israel. And they try to destroy the Palestinian new generation in early age. The starvation, for example, you have over 5,000 children inside Gaza Strip. For example, they are suffering from severe malnutrition right now inside Gaza. And this is according to the UNICEF, what they published a few months ago, reports. No one did a real study report, study, I mean, statistics, but these are the estimation. And these children, they are suffering in their daily life. How they will grow up? Like with malnutrition, it will impact you as a human being. If you are not shot and killed and shot and killed by the drones, the bombing, etc., you are already future, you're a future under threat. How to grow up inside this kind of environment. Already your health in danger, and you have children. There are tens of thousands of children. They are already injured during this genocide, and some of them they need immediate treatment outside Gaza because no real treatment inside Gaza right now. So they are not allowed to go back. The Israel is targeting, when I say targeting, the Palestinian children by having this kind of policies for children inside, like inside West Bank or inside East Jerusalem, and especially in Gaza. In the case of Gaza, they are targeted as they are killed. You spoke about ceasefire, like since the ceasefire, since October last year until now, we have over 265 children. They are already killed inside Gaza, targeted and killed. For other children in West Bank, they are targeted and killed. And at the same time, they are arrested and tortured. And there are some other children under home arrest. Imagine a child 12 years old, 13 years old, under a home arrest. Like this is the case of Jerusalem, where they don't want to keep the children inside the jail. They put them under home arrest in their homes. They transfer their parents instead to take care of their children. They become the police. They had to control their child, not to allow to leave their own home, because the moment they leave the house, the family will be punished at least a fine, $1,000. You see how this kind of system is working in different levels to make it difficult for these children to live and to survive at the same time, and to be a children, to express themselves. Where children sometimes they do a dance, the children they want to participate in different kind of activities. Children in their daily basis, when they go to school, they are searched, they have their bags searched, some of them arrested, and they are targeted. Some other children they lose their schools, like in the case of Msafer Yatta and different villages in the Palestinian villages around Ramallah, around Jericho, in the Jordan Valley, where it's destroyed. These schools destroyed. Even some of these schools, actually, we participated building one of the schools, and other organization, international organization, build these schools for children to just to be able to learn something. These are targeted. Absolutely, Palestinian children become a main target in front of the world. And the international organization, of course, Israel in the top of the list of the how they treat children, of course, in the top of the list, how they treat women, in the top of the list, they are committing genocide and still ongoing genocide. But no one hold Israel accountable when it comes to the Palestinian children right now. And no one even tried to put the pressure on Israel to stop these kind of attacks on Palestinian children. And yes, there is a huge threat for the future of Palestinian children everywhere inside Palestine, from Gaza Strip to West Bank to East Jerusalem. Even in 1948, they have Israeli citizenship, where they are suffering from different kind of discrimination in their schools, and they are not allowed to be Palestinian.
Ziad, you have an event coming up on July 19th. Tell the people what is happening, where it's happening, how they can be involved.
Yeah, thank you for highlighting that. Yeah, absolutely. We have a big event. It's annual, the fifth annual ride for Palestine. I don't believe I'm saying the fifth, because I remember the first year we are preparing for this ride for Palestine. And ride, it's a bike ride where the people they come. It's not like everyone should be a biker. This is like another way where we show solidarity with people of Gaza, people of Palestine, and especially in this time where we don't feel Palestine in the top of the news anymore. Palestine ignored, even what's going on, the genocide. And this fifth annual, the theme is about right of return, because most of the Palestinian refugees, most of the Palestinian people, they are refugees, and they are looking in Gaza. They are displaced. They are not allowed to be in their homes. And most of the Palestinian refugees, actually refugees living in the diaspora outside of Palestine. And this year it will be in July 19th, and it will be a festival for everyone, not just the bikers, for everyone, where the people they come together. And this is one of the ways how we raise funds for to continue to do the work we are working inside Gaza or West Bank or in Lebanon, to continue help and support Palestinian children and Palestinian steadfastness, and stay with them in our solidarity. And we are inviting the people to come to join us. The festival, it will be started around noon, where we will have Palestinian music, Irish music, where they have solidarity with Palestine. There will be Palestinian dabka, Palestinian food, and many speakers. They are speaking about updating about the situation in Palestine. And we are inviting the people to come to join. This is where we raise funds. Last year, by the way, we raised almost $500,000 for the people in Gaza in our ride. And we are still for the people to come. We are inviting the people to come to join. If you can't join, you have other plans. You can still go to the to rideforpalestine.com and donate and support your team. There are many teams, they are participating. And this is another way where we have a solidarity gathering to send a message with to the people of Palestine. You are not alone. Even in this very dark time, we are still thinking about you and we are standing with you.
Ziad, where can people register to attend on July 19th?
They can go to the rideforpalestine.com. They can go, they can start their own team, they can donate, they can support, they can register and come joining us.
Ziad, thank you so much for your work and for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me and the great work you do.
We have been speaking to Ziad Abu Shamrukh, Executive Director of Middle East Children's Alliance, or MECCA, for peace. That takes us to 8:29 in the morning here on Law and Disorder. I am your host, Kit Brooks. Right quick before we transition to our next guest, the homie Samer Arabi is in the waiting room. I want to replay because I think the resistance is so important because we're talking about children. If you missed it last week, you get a chance to hear it again. The interview that I did with a member of the Gaza Surf Club. Let's roll that tape.
Hello, my name is Abdullah Jawad Abu Ghanim, and I am calling from Gaza. I am a member of the Gaza Surf Club. Thank you for having me on your show, Katie Brooks and team. We know that you and KPFA care about us in Gaza. I am recording this message directly for you because our internet and phone service is not stable enough for a live call. Kat and the team sent over some questions and I want to answer them for you today. The first question was, why do I serve and what is my favorite thing about surfing? To me, surfing and getting into the water means surfing is my escape. When I am on wave, I forget the war, the fire, and all the breezes around me. The ocean is the only place where I truly feel free, calm, and alive. They also asked about how we actually manage to surf right now. For me personally, is it far to get the water? Gear is very hard to find. I do have my one surfboard as a club. We only have 7 surfboards in total. We are currently sharing gear that is over 8 years old because surf wax is impossible to import right now. We have to get creative and make our own out of solid materials and fire wax. Getting to the beach is the own challenge. I live far from other people who surf. Right now is unsafe to travel to the water and to surf. I also want to tell the KPFA listeners a bit more about why we surf and how we do it. We surf because the ocean gives us hope, even with very limited equipment. Before I finish, I want to talk a moment to honor and remember my family and friends, both those who are alive and those who are no longer with us. If you want to learn more about me, personal story, you can visit my Instagram account, Abdullah Abu Ghanim, and visit the link in the bio. If you want to learn more about our community, please visit the Gaza Surf Club website at gazasurfclub.com or check out our official Instagram page, Gaza Surf Club Official. Thank you, KPFA listeners. Thank EU Law and Disorder and host Kathy Brooks. And Kat, before I go, I hear that you serve too. I hope we can talk more about the waves again soon. Thank you so much from in here in Gaza.
That is the voice of Abdullah Abu Ghanem of the Gaza Surf Club. I almost made it through listening to it that time without crying, but not quite. Surfing as resistance. It takes us to 8:33 in the morning here on Law and Disorder. I am your host, Kat Brooks. Our next guest is Samer Harabi, member of the Arab Resource and Organizing Center and co-founder of AROC Action, as well as the Associate Director of Political Education and Research at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Good morning, Samer.
Morning, Kat. Always such a pleasure to be here.
They was asking me, who do you have anybody you want on Monday? I was like, where's Samer at? It's been too long.
It's been a minute.
That's who I want. Get Samer. Samer, I ain't finna speak ill of the dead, but that don't mean we don't tell the truth about you just because you're dead. And so I just want to give you an opportunity if you want to do some truth telling about Lindsey Graham and Palestine.
I mean, you know, sometimes you're waiting at a restaurant and your entree takes too long and they give you a free appetizer. That's totally unrelated to anything. I'm just thinking about food. Lindsey Graham, a nightmare, an absolute nightmare. I mean, probably, you know, most recently well known for, you know, when the Gaza flotilla was heading to Gaza, wrote, "I hope Greta can swim." Just real classy stuff. So, I don't know. I mean, yeah, the world is a tiny bit brighter today, but who knows why?
Right, who knows why? This last thing, and I'm going to move on because there's just this more important things to talk about. But just watching, this is like, not that I was not already disillusioned with politicians and politics, and particularly at the federal level, but kind of all over the place at this point. Watching like Joe Biden and other Democrats like write statements of condolences or honor to this man, I'm like, for real, for real? This, y'all. It's too much for me.
Yeah, all the establishment Dems, right? Your Amy Klobuchars and your Cory Bookers talking about my dear friend, Lindsey Graham, you know, like as if he wasn't an active and extremely corrosive force in ushering in authoritarianism and destroying whatever like fabric of existing governance existed. A horrific racist, an absolute bigot. A total enabler of Trump, who incidentally, strangely enough, whether through incompetence or pettiness, who knows, always left up his like one tweet back from the presidential primary of 2016 saying, if Trump wins, it will destroy us and we will have deserved it. Still up on his Twitter. So, you know, there's always that little piece of it, but that man did more than almost anyone else to enable Trump over these last 12 years. 10 years, so,
God, yeah, 10 years.
To thank him, my goodness.
Yeah, thanks, Lindsey. Do better next time. Samer, there's so many, but a headline today is that the United States, following the bombing of military stations in other places like Qatar and other spaces, is considering moving their bases to, wait for it, Israel. And if something like that were to happen, along with, let's say that's compounded with the National Defense Bill that has a merger of U.S. and Israeli military forces in it that looks like it actually might pass. I think the first time I reported on this, it was like this far off, ha-ha, never happened. That's not the case today. What might that mean for the region, for Palestine, for the world, actually, if you have these two fascist world powers combined in word and deed? We might have lost Samer. Did you lose me?
You're back. I did.
I can't. No, I can't ever tell if it's me or if it's the other guest. That I get yelled at if I don't talk. So I've just been talking. I was saying that one of the headlines is that the United States is considering moving their bases because they were bombed in Bahrain and Qatar and Kuwait to Israel. And so I'm wondering about your thoughts about that. But I'm wondering about your thoughts about how that gets compounded, right? If I'm gonna turn off my camera because I think I've lost you again. I'm wondering about how that gets compounded with the national defense bill that is moving to combine forces and strategy and technology, and what you think that that might mean.
Yeah, I mean, you know, first of all, this feels like
are having technical difficulties, or I am having technical difficulties. Sammer, turn off. There we go. Oh, we have lost Sammer. Oh wait, there is he back.
Woof. Can you hear me now? Sorry.
I can. It's all good. Let's go cameras off.
All right.
And see if that works. And if not, perhaps our engineer can just call him on the phone, because it looks like there's technological malfunctions happening with the Zoom. I'm going to keep talking until we get Sammer back on the air. And I know you can hear me typing. Excuse me, y'all. Okay, so what I'm talking to Sammer about is are you there?
I am here.
Okay, all right, go for it.
Yeah, okay. I've got another device in the waiting room, so if this cuts out again, just swap me over. But first of all, I think it's really important to understand that this was a predictable consequence of this, you know, extremely ill-fated Iran war, right? This idea that all of these bases and this whole idea of U.S. power projection in the region, you know, premeditated on the concept that, oh, you know, let us put all of these bases in all of your countries, let us flood your like local populace with U.S. troops, let us, you know, take over some of your prime real estate, is all on the idea that, oh, it's a dangerous world and, you know, only the U.S. can keep you safe. In this time of declining empire, we're seeing that it's the exact opposite phenomenon, right? That the thing that is the most danger to a country is the existence and presence of a U.S. military base, right? Like, that's the reason that Bahrain and all these other places are getting hammered by Iran in this war. And very tellingly, the United States can't do anything to stop it, right? Like, the bloated, corrupt, totally inefficient and backwards defense bureaucracy in this country, right? About to become much more bloated if this new $1.5 trillion budget gets passed, simply doesn't have the capability to sort of respond to modern military conditions, right? Iran throws a few $100 drones at a base, and their, you know, multi-million dollar defense systems have nothing they can do to stop it, right? We're really seeing something that echoes a lot of the sort of past collapsing of empires. You know, you're stuck in a sort of military thinking from an age that is already past. So just to say, sorry, as an aside, that, like, you know, that these systems are collapsing in real time, and we're watching it happen, and I think it's really important to consider that. At the same time, you know, never one to waste an opportunity. I think, you know, the Israelis are seeing this as a chance to sort of really bolster up a sort of increased interdependence between the Israeli and U.S. militaries, which is a terrifying prospect. You know, the fact that the NDAA is sort of moving along and is really difficult for us to sort of get enough political momentum to stop. Is a really scary thought. And I think the idea that the US becomes increasingly dependent on the Israeli military rather than only the other way around is a real prospect that we need to be thinking about and we need to be prepared for. But I think it's also really critical for us to understand this in, again, its sort of geopolitical context and as a consequence of forces that have come before it. And, you know, I've been hearing from folks here and there that, like, oh, you know, like the Israelis and the Zionist forces have, like, outplayed us because, you know, we have been pushing for an end to military aid and they've sort of figured out a way to get around that to the point where even Netanyahu can talk about ending military aid because, like, oh, they're doing it this other way now. It's going to be like joint coordination instead of military aid. I don't think that's a fair assessment, personally. I think that they are responding to a catastrophic strategic loss on their side, which is that ending military aid to Israel has now become a sort of expected base level position within the U.S. political discourse, right? And that's not only on the sort of progressive wing of the Democratic Party, but across the board, right? Through the Republican Party as well, and basically like the stink of association with Israel is just so broad now that this is a kind of pivot they've had to make. And it's a move of desperation, I think, not a move of sort of, 4D chess or whatever. But that doesn't make it any less dangerous. And I really do think that to the extent that folks can mobilize right now to exert any sort of political pressure in this moment, particularly with the midterm elections looming, it's this, right? It's to end this cooperation agreement in the NDAA, which I think will be, if we don't stop it now, it's going to be a fight we're going to be having for years to come.
Summers, we're running short on time, in part because I didn't book you for long enough, and then of course we had our technical difficulties. But before we, I've got like, I don't know, 3-4 minutes left with you. But you're going to just go ahead and book your calendar for next Monday because you got to come back.
Great.
Syria's parliament met for the first time since the Assad regime was overthrown 18 months ago. President Ahmed al-Sharaa has promised to usher in a new era for Syria. The main role of parliament, which is called the People's Assembly, is going to be to draft a new constitution and, as is being said, to lay the foundations for democracy. Meanwhile, al-Sharaa is in conversation with a fascist and appears to continue to be making deals with the devil. And as a result, Trump says the United States is going to remove sanctions against Syria that have been in place since the Assad regime for so long time. What was or is the quid pro quo? How do you imagine it's going to benefit Israel? And what maybe is this al-Sharaa missing in these conversations? I mean, because one of the first things I thought of, I was like, oh, so as soon as Trump is mad at you, you're going to put them sanctions back on again. You just entered his world of the yo-yo.
That's exactly it. I couldn't have put it better. And, you know, I almost feel bad for him. It's hard for me to feel bad for someone like Sharaa, but it's an impossible situation, right? And I think it really speaks to the sort of two political currents that we're seeing everywhere, including like here in local politics. And the fact that, you know, basically we're stuck in these sort of systems that aren't working. And we really have one of two paths laid out ahead of us. And Sharaa has clearly chosen one of those two paths, which is the sort of like accommodationist path, right? What can we do to sort of appease the powers? What can we do to cozy up to them? How can we befriend Europe and the US, you know, given the sort of crippling situation that Syria is in, the massive need for reconstruction aid and economic investment? The way for him, he sees to do that is to sort of cozy up to the Western powers, which of course means also cozying up to Israel, right? The allowances for the Syrian state to let Israeli planes fly over Israeli airspace, despite the fact that Israel continues to eat up Syrian territory in the southwest, is a clear example of one of these quid pro quo arrangements. But as you said, it doesn't work, right? Because at the end of the day, you're basing it on the goodwill of an actor that you already know to be unwilling to operate in good faith. And so it's only a matter of time before those people turn on you. And, you know, I think there's something there about also the sort of accommodationist attitude towards, you know, tech and AI here, right? The sort of like corporatist wing of the Democratic Party. Yes. I don't think I ever imagined myself making a connection between Ahmed Sharaa and Democrats, but, you know, why not? But it's the same idea, right? That like we can do this without any sort of radical agenda. We can do this without being bold. We can actually do this by being small and being meek. And we know how that plays out. We've seen it, you know, 100 times over. And, you know, as it goes for Syria, it shall go for San Francisco, right? It's the same idea of like, can we cozy up to the big powerful interests and will they keep us safe? And the answer is always no.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.